danger. So then you're saying, well, if the driver saw fit to stop the bus and to take the other people's life of danger, does his protection suddenly diminish as he gets out of his driver's seat? You probably could argue that it shouldn't diminish as he or she gets out of the driver's seat to go to the back to take care of this, you know.
Representative Bryan and Representative Baum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it would help if we said recklessly causes physical injury to an operator of public transportation while such person is in control of or operating the vehicle. So we've narrowed it to make sure we don't have the supervisor involved. But to me, if the driver or operator gets up and goes back and he's still on the bus and there's 20 people on the bus and an assault occurs in that close proximity to others, there is an aggravating factor present. I agree if he's off the bus, that's a different thing. But if he's on that bus in close proximity, I think there is a danger to the public that's different than supervisor standing outside.
Representative Baum.
Representative Bryan's correct. We have to confine, and Representative Mason, too, we have to confine it. If a woman or a man stops a bus and walks back to deal with the sleaze ball in the back, the sleaze ball assaults him, her while she's walking back there or something, they ought to be the same penalty for attacking him in the seat. Because he's stopping the bus, he's going back. It's not safe to stop buses, you know, outside of their normal stop and go routine. So if we can draft something to put language in there.
Put it in the vehicle.
The language.
Additional comments? Representative Johnson?
I'm just curious, what for, you know, slugging somebody in the back of the head, what is the current penalty if they're not driving a bus? Under current law, I mean, what is the guilty person here subject to if we don't pass this bill?
Depends on what you hit him with.
Depends on what you hit him with and how bad the injury is.
It's with extreme indifference for life.
It could be anything from I mean, if you hit him with a newspaper.
Coke bottle. We back to Coke bottle.
He's stuck on Coke bottle. If you hit him with a newspaper, it would probably be. Well, I think if you hit him with a newspaper while they were driving the bus, then that statute that I just copied for you would probably come into play, interfering with the public transportation. That'd be a Class A misdemeanor, or an assault 4, which would be a Class A misdemeanor. It could be if they distracted them while they were driving, so it was recklessly endangering. It would be a Class A misdemeanor, I suppose.
If we just added the word and
harassment's
the word or
Class A misdemeanor, I think too. And then at that point, once you do some sort of injury or what you use can cause some damage, like a Coke bottle, it would go up.
I think implicit in my question was assuming they don't have an assault that would fit under the third degree assault under the statute already, meaning that, you know, they're not attacking with a deadly weapon, etc.
Class A misdemeanor.
Class A misdemeanor. Okay. And the difference is 1 year versus 5 years. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Park.
Wouldn't this, the way it's written, cover a cab driver?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, because the public transit vehicle is not defined, the answer is possibly. And that's part of the reason why I was suggesting some sort of definition. Because I think that's actually a good example. Better than I had come up with.
I agree with Representative Mason. There is a logical distinction to make when bus, the farther you get away from that, the less of a rationale there is. Very logical reason when somebody's, and maybe when somebody's operating a cab, do unhappy customer to assault them. But when you switch over to control, I think you just invite all kinds of problems.
What about inside the vehicle there? I mean, I've kind of stretched to Chairman Miller's position that, you know, sleeve balls in the back, giving everybody a rough time. You stop the bus, walk back. You should still carry your kind of protection with you. But I draw the line when you're out of the bus. I mean, once you're out of the bus, you're
you know, you lose the protection. But I would say that this should be confined in the bus. I don't know how you feel about that, Chairman.
I agree with that.
Representative Baum?
If we add the words after on line 12, recklessly causes physical injury to another while such person is on a public transit vehicle and is in control of or operating a public transit vehicle, then define public transit vehicle as any vehicle that is operated by or under contract to any public body in order to provide public transportation. Public body means subsection there.
Let me ask a question about your last part under the public, under the control of public body, just so I know what that includes, what it doesn't, what some of the, they're probably private carriers, but like, what is the shuttle that runs between here and Portland for the airport, or there's, I know we have Lake Oswego Airporter, is that a...
It depends.
Is that going to fit in here with bus drivers of the TriMet sense?
Mr. Chair, I think it would, if Representative Baum wants to pick up the current definition, I think it would depend of whether or not it was operated by a public corporation or a private corporation. So that if, for example, my understanding is the one from the Salem Airport...
It's private.
Actually, I think it's public, but I think that it would depend upon what the contract was, but this clearly says a public corporation. So I think that...
Well, let me ask you, should it make a difference? If it's public or private, it seems to me maybe we're trying to afford protection to the driver enough. It probably doesn't make a lot of difference to the person committing the assault whether they are on a privately operated bus or a public bus. And I think we're trying to protect the public and the driver from greater injury caused by this assault during the time of the operation, whether it's a private or public vehicle. Well, perhaps what we should do here, Council, is find those, unless we have it, the points of agreement and agree to conceptually bring those that language either before us at a full if we're all together, or if we're not comfortable with that, we can
review the consensus.
Bring it back. Yes, Representative Johnson.
It occurs to me that the distinction that we're really trying to make here is a bus, whether it's owned by a private corporation or a public entity. If that bus is open to carry public passengers, I mean, if anybody can walk on the street and get a ride on that bus, that's the kind of bus that we're trying to prevent this activity from happening on. So if we could phrase the thing in that light, we'd be getting closer to home, I think.
Operator?
May I understand that intention?
Operator of vehicle.
Representative Parks and Mason, if you agree with this, we'll try to have language crafted, and that is that, is it your intention that if the vehicle, whether it is owned by a private operator or a public body, as long as it is open to the public in terms of who the passengers can be, would you intend to cover?
Yes. Yeah. In fact,
okay,
I think
that's
what
one.
Common carrier might even be a definition.
Okay. Whatever the appropriate language, and then.
I just voice a little bit of disagreement. I feel like we need to be real careful in general about exploding all of our criminal laws, and I know that we've done a lot of that this session already, and I would restrict this to a moving vehicle. I know that's different than some of the comments I've heard here today, but what we're really talking about is a distinction between just assaulting a person, wherever that person is, and assaulting a person at a time when that assault could result in injury to other people. And if you've got a stopped bus, if somebody walks up and slugs the bus driver, nobody else gets hurt. But if you've got a moving bus and somebody walks up and slugs the bus driver, the whole thing could wreck and you could kill a whole bunch of people. So I think that second evil is the one that's worth raising this thing up to. Trying to make the bus driver some kind of quasi-public police officer type person that has, you know, you can't touch him or you're really in trouble, I think we're really opening a can of worms there, that where are we going to draw the line, and, you know, next time it's going to be the ticket salesman, and, you know, where are we going to draw the line? So a moving bus, you keep your hands off the bus driver, you're in big trouble. If he stops, then you're back to your normal Class A misdemeanor.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, for defining your line. Further comments from the committee? Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in a way it would make sense to, and I may draft it one way if the committee does not scream, to add a second part to the interfering with public transportation statute and build on that, because in fact I think that's what the committee is doing, and it may be cleaner to add it to that statute, which already makes it illegal and a Class A misdemeanor to interfere with public bus drivers. It's really a step up from harassing or annoying them, and it may be cleaner to use this language and mend it into there. If no one has any violent, and I can do two parallel bills, but it may fit in better there.
Any other suggestions for council? Perhaps it might be best, if agreeable to the committee, that we work on this language, and we will have this back before the criminal law sub at our earliest opportunity, and take final action on it at that time. All right. We'll close the work session, House Bill 3167. And open. This is...
Okay. Might as well.
Same subject. Yep. Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2018. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2018 comes to you at the request of the Department of Justice. They are requesting another modification to the assault in the third degree statute to allow individuals who are part of group assaults to be charged with a more serious offense, a Class C felony.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Leggert? Ms., I'm sorry.
Chairman Miller, representatives of the committee, I have some written testimony I prepared, and this bill was actually an idea I had after prosecuting gang members as part of a federal task force up in Portland. And what happens, and it's like the classic that you see on television, is the group of kids will go out and attack, or kids or adults will go out and attack somebody based on significant things like the color of their clothing, and I've had several cases causing serious injury to the victim, but not serious under the statutory definition. And it was only a misdemeanor assault, and I thought, based on that, it was an inequity based on the seriousness of the offense, the way it affects the victim. They're extremely traumatized. Also, because when you're looking at equivalence, a theft in the first degree or drawing on the TriMet station is a Class C felony, but the a group assaulting a victim for a totally innocent person walking down the street was only a Class A misdemeanor. So that was why I came up with this suggestion to make it a felony. It's particularly, I think, important based upon the fact that sentencing guidelines consider these more serious and do not consider any juvenile misdemeanors at all in deciding in setting an adult's prison sentence. And I think it's a good idea to have sentencing guidelines and lock up more serious people, but I certainly think this conduct is more serious than a Class A misdemeanor. Any questions?
Thank you. Yes, Representative Mason.
We've had references twice now to the court's definition of serious physical injury, and it's a problem I'm vaguely aware of. Can you give me a cite or a description of that case?
I can't give you a description. I can give you a couple of examples of cases that have been up to the Court of Appeals, at least, where they have held that certain injuries are not serious, including a bullet that lodged in a person's head that did not have to, that could not be removed or should not be removed, and because there was no protracted impairment of the person's condition and because it was not life-threatening, the person was shot in the head, and the court said that was not serious physical injury. The statutory definition I've cited in my written testimony just is a very high burden of what you have to prove to show something is serious. So, for instance, if you have a broken jaw, broken arm, and broken ribs, which one of my victims had, and you healed, thank goodness, and actually the person was in the hospital for, I think, 3 weeks. It was not protracted. It was not life-threatening, but it was very serious to the person. So those are the kinds of injuries that we're getting that aren't serious physical injury.
Do we have our can you give me a cite quick, the definition?
Here.
Of? Okay, so what you're talking about, for the record here, the ORS 161015,
Sub 7, serious physical injury means physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death or which causes serious or protracted disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, or protracted loss or impairment of function of any bodily organ. Okay, that's, and so, okay. Well, it seems to me, and I think the committee should perhaps seriously consider this at this moment, and that is that this definition, the tightness of this definition has to a great extent led to the necessity for the other legislation, in the sense that this definition has been, and I'm not conversant with the case law, but this definition has been so, has been ratcheted down to such an extent, now we're seeing the proponents trying to expand out the other definitions when we might want to consider modifying this definition slightly, and I would suggest just off the top of my head, getting rid of the references to protracted disfigurement or protracted impairment of health or protracted loss or impairment of function in any bodily order, organ. As far as I'm concerned, you put someone in the hospital, that's serious, regardless of permanent injury, and I think that that this definition should be looked at now. Again, we're getting a little aside. That's something the committee wanted, but it is so tight that there's not much left of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bryan.
It seems to me that what this bill really is trying to do is in two situations where the physical injury is identical, where the crime was perpetrated by one person, it would be a Class A misdemeanor. If the same exact degree of assault occurred but by two people, that would be the aggravating factor.
Chairman, Representative Bryan, that's correct. And I wanted to point out one other thing. This parallels the robbery statutes right now. It's a robbery in the third degree if you commit a robbery by yourself. If you commit a robbery with another person, it's a robbery in the second degree. And I meant when suggesting this bill to actually parallel that language, and I noticed, forgot to mention this earlier, I apologize, that the language of the robbery statute has, it almost parrots that language but leaves out two words, and I'd suggest to parrot the language of the robbery statute, you would add after the word person, you put person actually present, and then the word intentionally, so that there's no confusion that what you are doing is saying that we have multiple assailants here.
Chairman.
Representative Bryan.
Well, given that the outcome of the assault in this example is the same, I guess value is being added by the number of people involved. Is that because of the potential for the incident to escalate because of more people involved or because of the more traumatic impact on the person being assaulted because of the number there? I mean, see what I'm trying to get at?
Right.
I'm not sure. I'm wrestling with whether or not the mere presence of an extra person justifies the aggravation if, in fact, the injury is the same.
Chairman, Representative Bryan, I understand the question. I think there's really, what I've seen is really several things. First of all, impact on the victim is much more severe if the person is assaulted by more than one assailant. Secondly, the chance...
Psychologically?
Yeah, it's scarier for them than just have one guy walk up to him, get into a fight with one person, and hit him. Secondly, the chance that you're going to be more effective at causing some injury, and particularly, and I'm convinced that the cases that I've handled, that the reason the person was hurt as badly as they were and sent to the hospital was because there were multiple assailants. If it had only been one person fighting the victim, it may have been, there would have been less injury. But because there's multiple assailants, basically the victim covers themselves up, lays on the floor, and tries to avoid having their head beat in, which is what's happened in these cases. And it also seemed to me that when you're looking at what is this person doing, it's very predatory. They get out in a group, and I think, as you mentioned, what they're doing is more... It should be more serious than I get angry with you. We're in a typical assault 4 case. We're in a bar. I get mad at you, and I punch you in the nose, and the two of us have sort of a mutual combat. This is very different, that your chance of success is increased substantially, and, in fact, the chance that the victim's going to be hurt increases substantially. I share Representative Mason's concern. I thought originally maybe we did need to change that definition of serious physical injury, but had a real hard time coming up with what does it mean when you're in the hospital, or how do you come up with that? And it just seemed that there was that this was another way to attack it that was easier, at least from this small perspective of the gang violence, which is what I'm trying to address.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Ms. Taggart?
Leggett.
Excuse me. You've got the word aided in here, while being aided by another person. I think I read that word as being your intent that two people actually both hit the victim.
Or one person holds and the other one hits them,
okay,
things like
there's,
that.
There's two people involved in this thing.
Right.
Not just being aided in terms of cheering on or anything like that. So I just want to get a good idea of your intent here so that if we go into work session, I can maybe propose some language that would focus that a little bit better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Bryan.
On that same question, wouldn't aided also include a lookout?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, what I try to do is parrot the language of the robbery statutes, and that's the way it's been, that's the way I look at it. The person has to be there actually actively participating, and would be different than somebody in a corner over here soliciting, for instance, where you'd be guilty of the primary action, but I've just solicited you to commit the crime or encourage you to commit the crime. I would think that you'd want, or my intent is anyway, that you want to have this be people who are actively participating in it. And that's my understanding of the way the robbery two and second degree statute has been interpreted, so I thought it would be good just to parallel that language. But you're right, that's the idea. You want somebody who's actually there helping out. And if it, in some of the cases, it may be even, you know, I just throw out some factual examples, it may be that they prevent the victim's escape. You know, they stand in their way so that they surround the person, and three or four of them are beating him up, and the guy tries to get away, and they block their path. So it may be that kind of participation, which I believe also is a reason we may want to add the language actually present, so we make sure we just get at those people who are there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, how many cases do you think you will prosecute under this new law if passed?
First of all, it's sort of hard to tell, but this personally, I've been up. There's four people on the youth gang strike force and that prosecute gang members, and I'm just one of those four people, and I've discussed it with the district court staff out there just trying to get an idea, because the misdemeanors on the adult side never go to our unit, and I was looking at the juveniles as well. I would think there would probably be of people that they catch, 20 to 30 people that would be prosecuted as felons who right now are being prosecuted as misdemeanors, because there's a lot more assaults that aren't prosecuted, but... And that's a year, because most of the assaults involve multiple assailants, and most of the time we don't catch all of the people. But that's just a guess off the top of my head. They didn't have a way to
20 to 30 is
of gang members that I'm talking about. Now there may be, that's just in the Portland area, gang members.
$2,000 to $3,000fiscal impact.
If the increased cost of defending a felony is estimated at $100, and these cases are currently being prosecuted, and defense being provided at a misdemeanor level,
right,
then the increase is what you would have to look at. And so, at 20 to 30, or even higher to 40, I think your fiscal impact is probably in the range of a maximum of $5,000. I don't know that there are a lot of gang cases brought outside the Portland metropolitan area, at least at this point.
So thank you, Council. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Chairman.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2018? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2018, open a work session, House Bill 2018. Members, just... I'm sorry, you had a question. Did you want to... You want her back up here? Sure, she'd be delighted.
We just kind of need to make sure that, I guess we had an aid and abetting statute. Generally applies to all criminal conduct. And what we're trying to do here, I guess, is trying to carve out a groove for when one or more persons, two or more persons, I guess, don't cause substantial serious physical injury, but cause physical injury by virtue of doing it together. And so we've kind of created a new category for for a C felony, which is going to be a gang of people picking on someone, but they don't hurt them real bad. They just cuff them around a little bit and cause the definition that Representation and I were discussing, which is the physical injury is defined as Representation. Do you still have that?
Yeah, physical injury is defined as means any means impairment of physical condition or substantial pain. And I was just checking with another counsel and back. Basically, you come up and slug someone hard. That hits that definition. And then the other problem we had was to get the next one is an almost too high, and that's the irony of it. We don't have any middle ground. I don't know where the chair wants to go on this, but it seems to me that we really have could resolve three issues here: the TriMet issue, the gang issue, and then the what I see is kind of an inadequacy of definition in assault in general, because you've got this bang, you know, or maybe she hits me more likely, and then the permanent physical disfigurement.
Put your carry side by side.
Chairman, hold your coat. You're in trouble.
He's in trouble if he holds.
Representative Baum.
Yeah.
We're trying to combat the fear people have of facing more than one assailant. It's worth the same treatment as if you have one assailant and you really injure the person. That's the decision we're making, is if you are challenged by two or three people and they put you in imminent fear and they might hit you a couple times.
Yeah, they could break your legs.
Whatever falls short of serious physical injury, and I know my judge would put him in the slammer for as far as they go if they broke someone's leg. It would qualify as serious, even if the law says it didn't. But in any case, so we're putting that in the same category as having three people who just might cuff them around a little bit. Well, I don't know.
Mr. Chair,
where are we?
We either move the bill or do something else with it.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bryan.
I was going to say, the issue is how much value we want to assign to the presence of other persons. The injury is the same. Well, but if you have just physical injury by one person versus the same exact physical injury by two or more parties participating, that aggravates it to a C. And that's the question, I think, policy question here, is whether having extra persons participating should in fact aggravate the injury in and of itself. I can see some rationale in terms of the inability to defend oneself, to flee, you know, with other people present.
Representative Mason has a good point, but I don't know whether it's easy to redefine a third or in between option. I don't know problem with this bill. I mean, it's good for anti-gang things, I guess. I don't have very many of those in the Grand or Wallala, but you know, we'll do something good for Portland here. Representative Mason thinks it's a good idea for his folks.
Further comments? Is there a motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me try one more.
Representative Mason.
Just a suggestion, and I'd like to hear from the committee on perhaps resolving this definitional problem that we come upon, and that is how broad the current definition of physical injury is and how narrow the current definition of serious physical injury is. I don't know what another committee wants to tackle that, but I can live with a bill if we moved the actually present amendment.
Not yet.
No.
With the actually present amendment, the reason I can live with the bill is that there is something about more than one person in an assault which is vicious and cowardly, and Representative Baum, with all due respect, I think you find might
no,
find
I'm talking
this
about
bill,
the ganging up on people.
Yeah, well, you might find this
two
bill has
one.
A little more application over in your area than
well,
you want.
Well, no, it's usually it's outside the bar, and there's two or three guys.
Yeah,
well,
that's my
one.
Point. And so, you know, I don't think this can be confined to Portland here.
No, but I don't think the Justice Department is finding its motivation from the cowboy bar, Letterbuck Room. But they might.
Yeah.
All right, did you want to move the actually present language?
I would, and I hope our proponent is still here so she can correct me if I don't state it properly. The line on line 12, it should read, or words to that effect, while being aided by another person, quote, actually present, or comma, comma, actually present, comma, intentionally or knowingly causes physical injury to another. And let me ask her a real quick lawyer's question. Are intentionally and knowingly the terms you want as opposed to recklessly? Are those the terms you want?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. So I'd move that amendment.
Representative Vice Chair Honorable Professor Mason moves in line 12. After the word person, insert the words actually present before the word intentionally. Is there a discussion of the motion? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, it is adopted. Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Bryan.
Does the phrase another person include persons as well? Automatically, you know, it says while being aided by another person intentionally.
Fortunately, there's a way to change Oregon law short of amending the Oregon Constitution. The Oregon Supreme Court strongly suggested that the state constitution would tolerate a non-criminal checkpoint program duly authorized by the legislature, and then the editorial goes on to suggest that we introduce the bill, which we did. Last week I testified on a bill, House Bill 2623, and some folks thought I spoke for over 14 minutes. I timed myself. It was around 7. So just to please everybody, I will not testify any further today. I am not an expert on DUII issues, and I yield this testimony and hearing to those who are. Are there any questions?
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barbara Stoeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Barbara Stoeffler, the legislative chair for Oregon Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I have, 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, I took my testimony for the record into your office, and perhaps you have it in your folders. If there is a time constraint, Mr. Chair, I will not read the testimony. It should take about 1 minute, that's all. If there's a problem with that, I'll just let you read it yourself.
All right. Perhaps if you could summarize your testimony, that'd be helpful and be available for questions.
For the record, each year, some 1.8 million arrests are made for drunken driving in this country. In Oregon alone, a total of 27,997 arrests were made last year. However, it is estimated that for each arrest, anywhere from 300 to 2,000 trips are made undetected by drunken drivers. That means it's not worded very well, but drunken drivers may drive 300 to 2,000 trips without being detected. An intoxicated driver may travel as much as 5,000 miles impaired by alcohol and or other drugs, equivalent to a coast-to-coast trip before being stopped for a DUII offense. It is small wonder, then, that impaired drivers think they can do so with impunity. Prevention and deterrence of driving after drinking or taking drugs require efforts on many fronts, including education of the public about the risk involved. And I think that to emphasize the deterrence effect of the roadblocks is what makes the roadblocks effective. It's the media coverage, the awareness of the public that there will be a roadblock. Therefore, it makes them foresee that there is a risk if they drive intoxicated, and that risk of being caught carries over into some of their future driving, and the results is a reduction of injuries or drunken driving out on our highways. I covered a little bit on the constitutionality of this, but Mr. Peter Higgins is here today. I believe he can do that for you. To finalize my comments, based upon research that roadside sobriety checkpoints have provided the most effective documented results of any enforcement procedure, Mothers Against Drunk Driving chapters in the state of Oregon have voted to endorse House Bill 2584. Although Oregon MAD would prefer full sanctions, we believe that House Bill 2584 clarifies the procedure under which roadblocks in Oregon would be constitutional. Today, Oregon cannot conduct roadblocks. Oregon MAD believes we should have that option. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you. Mr. Higgins.
Chair Miller, members of the committee, my name is Peter Higgins. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. The Department of Justice favors this bill. We believe it is legal. We believe it satisfies the requirements of the 1987 Oregon Supreme Court cases. I think Representative Burton stole my thunder on a lot of what I was going to say, but I have written testimony here, and I'll answer any questions that the committee has to.
Thank you very much, Mr. Higgins. Representative Baum.
Mr. Higgins, under, I think, the section 7, it's subparagraph A, line 33 of page 2, I guess, 33 and 34. Let's say you pull a person over, and the officer picks up signs of intoxication, breath or eye, whatever, and the person either flunks or refuses to take the intoxilizer, and the car's impounded. What's the procedure for dealing with that situation in real life? I mean, let's say you're out in the middle of the highway 30 going and you've got a checkpoint, the rodeo is on. I mean, how are you going to get folks home?
The officers are required to take the person, I believe, to the closest police station, which in the type of situation Representative Bond. For example, if the person was at the state fair, a person, as I am from Tigard, who was at the state fair and is stopped in Monmouth or some way on the way back, perhaps would be taken to a police station that is not convenient to him. But on the other hand, the police could hardly staff a roadblock and be expected to drive everyone to their home in all four corners of the state. So, but they will not be stranded out in the middle of nowhere.
Representative Baum.
There is some, I guess, notice provisions you'd call it in the statute where it's required that there be some advance warnings of the existence of the roadblock on the highway itself. That say that it'll be visible to oncoming motorists. Is there, what kind of notices are we talking about? Are we talking about a quarter mile away, a half mile away? Are we talking about newspaper articles? It'll say this stretch of the highway, there's going to be a sobriety checkpoint there next Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I mean, this gets kind of soft.
Chair Miller, Representative Baum, that type of thing is to be established by the police on pre-established guidelines in each case. I believe the Supreme Court cases have stated that advance warning is required. That usually means a quarter mile, half mile in advance. At least there's some kind of lighted cones to protect people so that they know this is coming up. They won't be frightened by it and so on.
What happens if you see the cones and you just decide it's time to do a U-turn.
Chair Miller, Representative Baum, that's the case currently of Pooler versus Motor Vehicles Division, which exactly that type of thing happened. Mr. Pooler was arrested not at a roadblock, which, although the officers did not know it at the time, would subsequently be ruled illegal. Mr. Pooler made a U-turn, and the officers went after him on reasonable suspicion that he had evaded the roadblock. That arrest was thrown out by the Supreme Court of Oregon. We believe that under the House Bill 2584, that would possibly be a valid stop if you could say that he was evading the roadblock. The language in this statute is a person who drives through the roadblock. Making a U-turn perhaps might not be held by the court to fall into that category.
The language of the bill, Section 5, states that the operator does not stop at the roadblock when asked or is signaled to do so. Now, you're going to see these cones a few hundred yards or a few hundred feet anyway away from when you get to the cones, unless it's just right around a corner or something and you're there before you know it, then you maybe haven't complied with the warning requirements. And the person just, for whatever reason, the fact is they're going fishing and they don't want to be stopped, or they're intoxicated. That's kind of the two scenarios, is they don't want to be inconvenienced. The other one is that I'm drunk and, my golly, if I drive up there, they're going to catch me. They do a U-ey before they get to the warning cones, or even before they get to the roadblock itself. And you're telling me that we don't have any law on that?
Chair Miller, Representative Baum, what I am trying to say is that most legislation is developed by courts on a case-by-case basis, depending upon specific facts. If the officers stopped a person under those circumstances, the case law would be developed as to whether that was good or not, and that perhaps it would be developed in one case based upon a half mile in advance, another based upon 3/8 of a mile in advance, how well lighted it was. I'm not sure you can possibly draw legislation that specific other than to see what the police guidelines and operation were on a case-by-case basis.
The purpose of the public policy here of giving warnings for the roadblock, safety for the approaching drivers, or to give people notice that they may want to avoid this stop. What are we talking about here? What's the policy driving that provision?
I believe we're talking more about safety than anything else. Representative Baum, we're also talking to some extent about the subjective fear, if you will, intrusion that occurs under the Supreme Court's balancing test involved in these cases. Part of the analysis is the intrusion upon the motorist. That intrusion is, to some extent, subjective, but it is a subjective analysis not in terms of the perception of a drunk driver. It's a subjective analysis in terms of how would a reasonably sober, law-abiding citizen view this situation? The U.S. Supreme Court has announced that rule just this last year in the Michigan case.
They favored safety over the intrusion.
That is correct.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Higgins. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tony DiLorenzo from the Motor Vehicles Division. In my brief prepared testimony this afternoon, I will address three issues: feasibility, effectiveness, and cost. First of all, feasibility. The division should have no trouble with the license suspension provisions of this bill because they're virtually identical to the existing implied consent system. The vehicle impoundment provisions should have little effect on the division because they're administered by law enforcement agencies. second effectiveness. There is research which supports the idea that measures that increase the perceived chance of punishment for drinking drivers do have a deterrent effect, and I would expect that to the extent that this bill increases the perceived chance of punishment, it would have a deterrent effect and would be effective. Finally, cost. Since it's virtually identical to the implied consent system, it should cost us no more to administer than it does the implied consent system. The actual cost would depend on the volume. We talked to police agencies when this bill was introduced last session and got different responses. Some thought that it might increase their suspension activity. Others said that it would not change the number of suspensions they submitted to us. That concludes my prepared testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. DiLorenzo. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Claire Ann Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for hearing my testimony or my witness. I concur wholeheartedly with the gentleman who spoke before before you adjourned for a while. I don't know his name, but the man who was speaking out here and brought up the questions of how far does this intrusion on privacy go. I'm a member of the Libertarian Party, and I suppose you are familiar that we are defenders of the strict constitutional liberties, and we're saying that your task here as governors is to secure individuals' liberty and privacy. And all of these good arguments, yes, you could go through everyone's home and search them and maybe turn up, maybe something was stolen. It's totally erroneous to go about business this way, and it's an opening and a big step toward the police state. And as far as the Supreme Court decision saying that the public welfare was favored over the privacy issues and the Fourth Amendment was not violated by this, I can only point out that certain Supreme Court decisions have been grossly mistaken, as subsequent history has pointed out, namely the Dred Scott decision and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Crawford. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Mr. Fadanke? No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fadanke, Associate Director, ACLU of Oregon. I was not expecting to testify on this bill today. We were hoping that John Henry Hinkson would be able to testify on our behalf. He was here last week, was unable to return today. I wanted to question one of the assumptions that I believe underlies this proposal before you today, which is the perceived effectiveness of sobriety checkpoints. And I wanted to start by telling you the real story behind the Oregon Supreme Court case that has given rise to this legislation, the case of Linda Nelson versus Lane County. Ms. Nelson, at the time of that particular roadblock, had earlier that evening had been attending a Christmas party that the mayor of the city of Eugene had put on. She was driving to her home in Marcola after that party, and just outside of the Springfield city limits came upon a roadblock. What I think is most interesting is that about 2 minutes before she got to that roadblock, she had been following someone on the highway who was weaving all over the road. That person went off in another direction. Virtually all of the police officers on duty that night were at this drunk driving roadblock, rather than out patrolling the highways looking for signs of people who were intoxicated. She was stopped at the roadblock. She tried to tell the officers there about this drunk that she had been following just minutes before. And as a result of her attitude, was required to do some field sobriety tests and eventually was released and sent on her way because she was sober. She was offended by that. She felt that she had a constitutional right to travel the highways without being subjected to a stop and interrogation by the police unless she had done something wrong. And that, I think, is the principle that underlies the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in Nelson versus Lane County. Now, what I presume the committee is going to be struggling with here is trying to craft something that accomplishes what you really want to accomplish, which is to give the okay to drunk driving roadblocks without running afoul of that decision by the Oregon Supreme Court by making this go over the line into a criminal type of legislation. You may be able to do that. I would submit to you that it's not a good idea to try. I think the evidence is clear that saturation patrols are a much more effective way of actually catching drunk drivers. If you use regular patrols or saturation patrols on the highways, then you can not only suspend the driver's licenses of those drivers, you can also convict them under the criminal laws of this state. And I think that's the most appropriate way to deal with drunk drivers. That's the extent of my testimony today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Panacki. Are there questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
So David, what you're saying is this may be constitutional, but you don't think it's good policy.
Exactly.
Do you have any information at all about the relative expense of saturation patrols versus checkpoints?
I don't, right off the top of my head. But I do know that at least one police agency in this state made a policy decision a number of years ago before the decision in Nelson versus Lane County, and that's the Springfield Police Department, to use saturation patrols rather than roadblocks at the time when roadblocks could still be done. I know they were convinced that saturation patrols were not only more effective but more cost effective in the long run in terms of getting drunks off the road.
Further question?
Well, just maybe a clarifying question, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the chance to sit in and ask the questions. Although not a constitutional, although your concern doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional concern, you do still raise a civil liberties concern.
Absolutely.
As I take it.
Yes. And I certainly wouldn't intend my testimony today to imply that the ACLU believes this proposal is constitutional. I don't know whether it is or not, and I don't want to tell you that it is unconstitutional. It may be.
Let's assume for a minute that it is constitutional.
Right.
Okay. You're still raising a civil liberties concern.
Absolutely.
Okay, and I'm trying to get at the bottom of that.
The heart of the matter.
How is a sobriety checkpoint more intrusive of civil liberties than airport security systems, than a whole host of other things that none of us like, but all of us sort of put up with? I need some context, I guess.
Well, one answer to that is that the ACLU opposes airport security checks too. But the long
answer—something to be said for consistency.
The long answer is that we believe that if people have not given some external evidence that they are violating the law, they should be free to move about from place to place without being stopped and interrogated by government officials. And in the case of people driving under the influence of alcohol, we believe that there are more than enough instances of people who are exhibiting signs of driving under the influence of alcohol to keep police officers busy. And we think, in fact, that those traditional methods are a more effective way of deterring and catching drunk drivers than roadblocks are. Roadblocks certainly have some appeal in terms of being flashy, literally and figuratively, but we believe that if they were analyzed in an objective fashion, it would be clear that in terms of the results of roadblocks, the results are not worth the amount of effort and resources that are put into them. And they're certainly not worth running right up against the edge of what is permitted under the Constitution.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Park.
What is to stop the idea of roadblocks from being expanded to include that the checkpoint is to check for things in addition to alcohol?
Like vehicle safety equipment, that sort of thing?
No, I'm thinking about
other criminal matters.
Other criminal matters.
Well, my understanding is that once you have a valid stop, no matter what the reason, if an officer finds evidence of criminal activity, they're free to move on from there. So certainly I would expect that some of these stops would potentially lead to those kinds of situations, unless there's something in the bill I haven't seen that prohibits that from happening.
Okay, thank you. I don't know that that's true, but I want to flag that issue for later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Podanky.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2584? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Jerry Cooper, and I'm the legal services coordinator for the Board on Police Standards and Training in Monmouth. I'm not speaking today on behalf of the board. I'm speaking as an individual citizen and attorney. I'm representing the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, a group that's been formed for the past 8 or 9 years, and it was the Governor's Task Force on DUII in 1983, which sponsored and helped create the so-called Senate Bill 710 for suspending people's licenses after they've been arrested for DUII for refusing or failing the breath test. The Governor's Advisory Committee is very much in favor of the concept of roadblocks in order to deter persons from driving while under the influence of intoxicants. And I understood your comments, Representative Miller, about any criminality coming into this bill. But this group of 20 people who have been meeting, as I say, for 8 years and discussing and hearing testimony about the problems of DUII and how to correct them have come to the conclusion that this may not be the best approach because of the fact that there may not be the deterrent effect because police may not use this as a tool because of the economics of this particular period of time and also the fact that by my informal survey, not again as a member of the Board on Police Standards and Training staff, but just talking to police around the state, I don't believe that they're inclined to be real aggressive in just stopping people, suspending their licenses, impounding their cars. The police want to make arrests, I'll be honest with you. They want this to be a situation where they can take steps to arrest people and go through the Senate Bill 710 approach. What we're recommending,
Scooper, it seemed last time when we had this bill up, it seems to me we had an extensive discussion about the situation. It was almost conceptual where these roadblocks were not even run by the police, were run by the DMV, and they essentially were a pure administrative inspection type situation. No criminality attached to it whatsoever, that you're driving along and then suddenly there's a gentleman or a gentlewoman there and probably in a orange vest waving you over. And they sobriety is checked there. If you fail the test, they can confiscate your car. If you refuse the test, your license is suspended. And you could even throw in an administrative fine in there if you wanted for driving while intoxicated. But nothing criminal about it, purely civil, and not a badge in sight. And I was kind of attracted to that idea. I couldn't get my friends in the kind of the erstwhile DUI bar interested even in that, but it seemed to me there was something to this purely administrative, and the reason I picked up on it was that the case talks in terms of administrative, and now you're bringing up the fact that the police officers, bless their hearts, don't like doing that type of work because you're not going to get to arrest anybody in this. You know. What's now, your comment on that?
And I agree. I think that's part of the problem, but it isn't just that. I was in Eastern Oregon just this weekend, and comments were made, we don't have the facilities to detox people when we just happen to come across them, drunk in public. What are we going to do when we erect these roadblocks looking for those kinds of people, and then we have no place to take them if they don't live in the locality? So it's more than, if they're under arrest, they can go to jail, and they can be detoxed there or released as if a third party is able to pick them up, or they just sober up and then they're released on recognizance or bail. But I understand that there is a House Joint Resolution number 34, and I just happened to notice that Representative Miller introduced it, which would be a referral to the people to amend the Oregon Constitution to give victims rights under the Bill of Rights. And our recommendation as a committee, to be very point blank, is that the legislative session this time around should consider referring that measure to the people, and that would allow criminality if it was passed by the voters in 1992. Then come back in 1993 and you could be looking at a bill that would set up administrative roadblocks, but from the standpoint of enforcing it as a criminal law and not just as a administrative procedure. It's my understanding if House Joint Resolution number 34 is not referred out by the legislature, the supporters of it are going to attempt to obtain signatures on a petition initiative drive, and if they can get the signatures, have it on the ballot in November of 1992. But I think you need to hear from the police. Maybe I did not attend all of the hearing, but it's I think it'll be significant to hear as to what their attitude is going to be in running the roadblocks, in dealing with the detoxification aspects, and also the impoundment, when they're going to have to hold hearings and go through that type of administrative process. They're not used to that, and you might want some input there as well.
Representative Baum?
Well, judging from your testimony, your feeling is whether this is a good or bad idea, it's not